now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
This is a podcast from The Times. Go to thetimes.co.uk.
Welcome to the Game Podcast, and yes, we're back for another season, 2011-12, seems like only yesterday. With me today to discuss the big issues, Ben Smith, Tom Dart, and of course, Ollie Kay. We'll be looking at the Community Shield, asking if the balance of power in the Premier League has shifted, and also, we'll be reflecting on our wishes and hopes for the upcoming season. So please join us for the next 35 minutes or so. All right, let's start with the Community Shield. And I have to ask this. What kind of a manager is 2-0 down? He's playing his city rivals. He decides to take off his three veterans, Rio Ferdinand, Nemanja Vidic, and Michael Carrick, and replace them with Phil Jones, Johnny Evans, and Tom Cleverley. Now, Ollie, I have to ask, is Sir Alex a genius savant who knew that this would make his team better? Or was he perhaps underscoring the fact that maybe, ooh, we're 2-0 down against the noisy neighbors. We may well lose this. Let me go and put on the kids so that afterwards I can just say that it's basically glorified friendly. It doesn't matter.
Well, that is what he was going to do anyway. He was going to send, he was going to put Cleverley, Jones, and Evans on at halftime, regardless of the scoreline, whether it had been 0-0, 2-0 down, 3-0 up, whatever. So he even considered starting with Cleverley until Michael Carrick surprisingly made an appearance in training on Saturday. But in answer to the question, what kind of manager? It's a brave manager. It's a manager with conviction and with a lot of faith in youth and the young players at his disposal. And I would suspect that at the time when he put those players on, he thought, well, this could go either way. But I think he probably felt that City were flattered by the 2-0 half-time lead. I think most people would agree with that. Probably even Roberto Mancini. And the young players that came on just did a fantastic job, whether it was... they all did. I wouldn't even want to single anyone out, but I'd say Tom Cleverley in particular did make a really good impression.
You're allowed to single people out. You're not the United manager, Ollie. You know, it's okay to single out young English players for praise if they deserve it.
Well, I was going to single out him, and then I thought, well, then there's Smalling and there's Jones, and you don't want to just list off the whole team, because that whole second half team, which was all youngsters, they all did extremely well. So that is the reason why I didn't want to single people out, because I thought I'd be here for a long time.
Ben, I don't want to blow more smoke here, but frankly, when you look at United and you look at, I mean, I have to take my hat off to them. It's also the guys who weren't there. You're talking about, you know, Chicharito Hernandez. You're talking about Valencia. You're talking about Giggs. You're talking about Darren Fletcher, who everybody's forgotten about. Then he takes the guys off at halftime. He brings on, you know, Johnny Evans, who frankly had a rotten season last year, I thought. It is kind of creepy. Is this a sign of the season to come?
I think it might be. I think it's a sign of what Ferguson can get out of a squad that doesn't necessarily man-for-man match up with the likes of Manchester City. I think, as Ollie said, it shows a real faith in the depth of the squad there. A player like Cleverley can come on, and we're all thinking Fergie's just doing this to try and use an excuse later on. A player like Cleverley comes on, changes the game, bring real dynamism, inventiveness, and United go on to win it. I mean, it is ominous, you have to say that. I mean, it's there's a real collective spirit there that I don't think is there in the other teams in that top four and five, and I think that probably just puts United ahead of the pack at the moment.
Tom, do you dissent?
No, I completely agree. I think on the evidence of yesterday, it is impossible not to have United as favourites above City when all the pre-season hype was starting to wonder if this could be City's year. But United looked like more of a team, and the new signings like Ashley Young blended in superbly. And the only question mark from the day was the goalkeeper, who made a couple of good saves in the second half, but probably should have stopped Dzeko's goal. We're not quite sure how good he's going to be. He's the major question mark. If he turns out to be bad, then things might change. But the rest of the squad, as you say, without Chicharito, who could be the top scorer in the Premier League this season, they look highly impressive up front.
Ollie, let's get to David De Gea. At fault for both goals?
No, I would point the blame elsewhere for the first goal. I mean,
he's supposed to stand there?
Was he supposed to stand there? Well, I don't think Rio Ferdinand and Nemanja Vidic were supposed to allow Leska a free header from about six yards out. So I think that was the problem there. You could even, in defence of him for the second goal, say that there was a huge great gap between Anderson and Carrick behind Anderson and Carrick, and that Vidic stood off Dzeko for the shot. But I mean, clearly he would be expected to save that. I think most goalkeepers would be expected to save a shot like that for 30 yards, albeit that it moved. I don't think his footwork was right. And there was then that frightening stat regarding the number of goals he conceded from outside the penalty area last season, which I think will probably be conceded every time he concedes a goal from outside the area this season. But I think he showed his quality in the second half. Only glimpses of it, but he showed quality. He's a commanding presence, good reflexes, good agility. Is he automatically an improvement on Van der Sar? I think that's an awful lot to ask, but he looks a good, competent, and very promising goalkeeper.
Well, let's get into this for a minute, because I'll give you a stat. Only four goalkeepers in the history of the game have moved for more than £11 million. Two of them moved this summer, and two of them moved more than a decade ago. The four are Angelo Peruzzi, Gigi Buffon, Manuel Neuer, and now De Gea. It seems extraordinary to me when you consider that in the last 5 years alone, you know, you've had 28 defenders moving for that amount of money. And that's obviously another, you know, unglamorous position, and goodness knows how many midfielders and strikers. I just wonder, with him being 20 years old and with such a huge valuation and, you know, put on his head, when, you know, you could get Martin Stecklenburg, who isn't my favorite goalkeeper, but I know a lot of people rate. You know, he ended up going for what, $7 million. Is this a new thinking in football, Tom? That maybe, you know, we have been underrating goalkeepers, or is this kind of a crazy punt for a guy who's fourth choice for Spain and has as many international caps as you do?
For that fee, it was a bit of a punt on someone so young, when the conventional wisdom does say that goalkeepers don't enter their prime until after 25, maybe even 30 for some of them, such as Van der Sar, perhaps.
You don't necessarily want to buy a guy in his prime. You want to buy him before he gets to his prime, right?
But you don't want to play him before he's in his prime, do you? So you might want to buy him, but you want to have an experience, the guy who they won't let you down week in, week out. I think it's just logical that we have been, as you say, underrating the importance of goalkeepers, which you could make an argument they're the most important player on the pitch for a side. They really can make the difference. So it seems sensible that although they're not as sexy as strikers, they should start going for these kind of big fees.
Ollie, are you surprised by the stat I gave you?
I'm always surprised and extremely impressed by anything you say, Gab. So it's the idea that there had been no goalkeepers moving for that kind of for even £11 million plus in a decade is pretty surprising. So well done on that one. And but I mean, you could also say that very few players in football history have moved for as much as Andy Carroll did. And I mean, I think there is suddenly an atmosphere now where if a club wants a player and a selling club doesn't want to sell, you do have to pay top dollar for them, whether it's Stuart Downing or Jordan Henderson or Andy Carroll at Liverpool, or whether it's De Gea or Phil Jones at United. It just seems that people are having to pay top dollar for the players that they want. It's not just goalkeepers.
Ben, let's talk City. Any evidence that they're any closer to closing the gap? And I should point out that, you know, in the game, three out of seven Times writers, foolish ones like myself, pick City to win the Premier League. Do you see the gap narrowing at all? I mean, Mancini really wanted to win this. He put out what he thought was his best possible team.
No, I agree. He did desperately want to win it. But yesterday, I think if you watched that game, you would probably say the gap hasn't closed. But I think you got to remember that, you know, there's no Aguero, there's no Tevez. How long he stays, I'm not sure. But this is a side that looks very similar to the one we saw last season. So to judge them on that one game, I think, would be unfair. I think there is a feeling they are developing. And I think Aguero perhaps suits their style better than some they've had in the past. I think the likes of David Silva, having settled last season, he looks like a real talent. And I only expect him to do more and more this season. So I think we have to genuinely, you know, consider them title contenders. Whether they've closed the gap enough to bridge it, I don't think they have just yet.
If City don't win the league, it will be down to Mancini, because I don't see any excuse for them not winning the league this season. They've got the players, you know, to keep talking about gelling as if this is some kind of grill cream advert, you know, but I don't see any excuse. If they don't win the league, it will be because the manager has not done his job.
Isn't there a feeling just behind the scenes that something's just ready to go wrong all the time? I get that impression with City, that you're almost just waiting for the next incident. You don't get that impression about United. There's that settled feel. You just feel, you know, that's not going to happen there. City, you're almost waiting for it.
You know what, though, but you say that, right? And that's a conventional wisdom. I agree with you. But by the same token, you know, United last season, you know, you had Rooney's dispute. You had,
fair share, yeah,
you know, a certain player. Can we name him now? I think a certain player who's now been named, who was involved in, you know, in a tremendous off pitch distraction.
I agree, but
you know, maybe it's not so much a controversy; it's the way the club handles it, perhaps.
Yeah, but I mean, I don't think those incidents at United that ever really affected morale in the dressing room. Of course, the Rooney incident wasn't great, and you know, that will have had an effect in the dressing room, but it was all brought back in house very quickly. It was dealt with and they moved on. I think at City the worry is that things linger, and perhaps there's slight feelings between players that aren't dealt with at the time, and that's allowed to go on. I mean, I may be wrong, maybe being unfair here, but I just get that feeling something's ready to perhaps go wrong there.
Part of that is because Mancini assigned so many players who he's then discarded within 6 months or a year, who the club can now not get rid of, who are just kind of lurking around the training ground,
like
moping around, harbouring bitterness and
like
resentment.
Who?
Well, half the team.
Oh, who didn't play
yesterday? Right, Phillips, Bridge.
Oh, these are all Mancini
Bellamy
signings, yeah?
Not all of them, no.
You said Mancini signed all these players. Just these three guys you mentioned were all signed by Mancini's predecessor, and they were all signed to ridiculous wages, which is why they're so difficult or impossible to sell.
Kolarov, next season,
Kolarov's playing. It's not like he's hanging around moping.
He won't be playing when Gael Clichy's in the team.
Ooh,
though,
Gael, the guy who has a girl's name. Ollie, bring some sanity here, please.
No, the thing Tom said, I mean, I would agree with Gab. They are all Mark Hughes signings that Mancini has fallen out with and wants rid of, and City have this problem where they can't offload these many malcontents because they're all on such huge wages, which is the wages that they had to buy to pay to get them to the club in the first place. So it's this vicious circle in some ways, and they're going to have to end up taking huge hits on them and so on. But to agree with what Ben said, I mean, there is just this constant feeling, and it's not just something that journalists have. It comes out of the club. There is this constant sense that things are on the verge of unravelling. Now, I remember speaking to a player's agent just before the Cup semi-final against United last April, and he was saying there are an awful lot of things that are coming to a head in that dressing room. There's an awful lot of tensions that is about to erupt if they lose on Sunday or Saturday, as it was. And the fact that they then won that game, I think, basically bonded the team together completely, focused them completely, and they had a brilliant end to the season, ended up finishing third, winning the FA Cup. And they now have the opportunity to build on that and to build towards a better future. But there are still those issues. It's still a very fractious squad. It's not got anything like the organic growth that you would have at United or at most clubs. And you're not going to get that when a team has had to build overnight and chop and change as quickly as City have. So that is the big question mark against them. I think a lot of City fans will say, why do you always make a big deal of these incidents when it's us? A, because there are a lot of them, and B, because that is the big problem that City have, that their cross-City rivals don't have. And United can have issues in their dressing room, whether it's, you know, one player sulking or Wayne Rooney going public on his contract dispute last season, but they never unravel the whole tapestry which has been built over, or woven over decades, not months.
Well, at the end of round one, it's Ollie Kay on 15 points, Ben Smith on 12, and Tom Dart on 2.
They all hate Mancini, though, don't they, these players that he doesn't pick? It's not whether he signed them and dropped them or just isn't playing. Now, the point is that the people like Bellamy, he's fallen out with a lot of them, and they're on the fringes.
But who cares? I mean, you can't. I mean, unlike Obertan, who loves Sir Alex Ferguson. I mean, Bebe, who sends it. Well, actually, Bebe has a lot to be grateful for to Sir Alex. I take your point. It's a huge squad. By the same token, though, if you inherit players who, you know, you don't think are good enough for your team, and you can't sell them because these guys won't take pay cuts to go elsewhere, and they're stuck there like some kind of strange venereal disease, what are you going to do?
Not buy a load more players. It just makes the situation
instead keep playing with the bad players.
They're not bad players.
But Wayne Bridge.
Would he have declined so much had his manager not lost faith in him?
How did Wayne Bridge decline? You have to be up here at some point, right? You have to be high. Well, he hasn't been. Wayne Bridge hasn't been Wayne Bridge since he was at Southampton, has he?
No, I'd agree. But supposed to make his players better, not sit there as they just get worse. Anyway, ultimately...
That's right, Mancini, you're not allowed to buy anybody. Just take all the crappy players you inherited and make them better.
Ultimately, your argument will fall down because Mancini signed Balotelli. And that, fundamentally... You can't say anything else beyond... After that, you just can't say anything. End of.
I wish James Ducker were here because I knew he would stick up for Super Mario. But anyway. But look, Tom, of course, siding with those managers who have never made a bad signing in their life, assuming Balotelli turns out to be a bad signing. In our debate this week, we're going to be asking, is there a bit of a changing of the guard? Because from where I'm sitting, I see Manchester United and Manchester City have bought players. Liverpool have bought a lot of players, although personally I'm not sure how they all fit together. Spurs, Arsenal, and Chelsea, i.e. three London clubs, have basically sat on their hands. With the odd, you know, Oriol Romeo and Romelu Lukaku and Gervinho and whatever. But it seems bizarre. Now, I imagine that there are different reasons for the inactivity of the London clubs, and I also imagine that it's going to change between now and the end of the season. But let's start with Ollie, our northernmost participant. Is there a shift north, and specifically to the northwest?
Would it really be a dramatic shift? I mean, I think most Premier League titles have ended up in Manchester, haven't they? So it's not like London has dominated the Premier League.
Yeah, but they've ended up at one team in the Northwest.
Yeah, but
Liverpool and City have won as many Premier League titles as QPR has, right?
Yeah,
it's all exactly. United. Based. It's been all United, and now it's possibly slightly more spread out.
Yeah, but Liverpool were the second best team in the country for a period, and were doing extremely well in the Champions League, and it looks like Manchester City have effectively replaced them in what was the big four, but a lot of Liverpool fans will be thinking that they can break back in this season, perhaps at the expense of Arsenal. I don't think there's a sort of north-south shift as much as a sort of perhaps a concentration of power in Manchester. I mean, United have got what they've always had in terms of the experience, the desire, the quality, the qualities that you need to compete for and win trophies. City, with 3 years now and under the ownership of the Sheikh, should be in a position to challenge, and they have certainly they've certainly got enough players on paper to be able to make a a decent squad. Whether it works on the pitch, we don't know. But I mean, I think if we're looking at Chelsea and Arsenal and writing them off, well, if we're writing off Chelsea, it's a... I'm slightly surprised that none of us in the Times this morning picked or tipped Chelsea to win the league. I would have thought at least one out of seven would think Chelsea, because they've got quality. It wouldn't require an absolute genius to get of a manager to get that team playing together again and get the most out of those individuals. They've got players who have got the quality, have got the experience, have got the character. Villas-Boas is a risky choice, but it wouldn't be a complete surprise if perhaps having added one more player before the end of the month, if they are the team rather than City to take the challenge to United.
I want to ask another question, though, and turn this around a little bit. Why have Chelsea, Arsenal, and Spurs, why haven't they signed anybody? Why haven't they done anything? I mean, it's August 8th. I mean, I know they signed some players, but this inactivity. Now, Ben, is it a case-by-case basis with these clubs?
I think it certainly is. I think you look at Arsenal, and it's been the whole pre-season has been overshadowed by the ongoing sagas with Nasri and Fabregas. I think they've been waiting to try and resolve those to some extent before they make the moves for the, you know, for instance, Arsenal are interested in Mata, but I think, you know, I think in the next week or so we'll have an idea of what's going on with Fabregas, and the Nasri situation hasn't helped either. So I think Arsenal have been very much focused on that, and that has taken away from what perhaps they should have been doing in the transfer market, regardless of those outgoings.
What excuse do Chelsea and Spurs have?
I think Chelsea, Villas-Boas has wanted to get in there and see what he's got. I think, yes, you're right, it is an ageing squad, and he's...
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Certainly needs to add to it, but I think we can't underestimate the potential impact he could make. You know, I think he's going to bring a very different approach to the game this season in England. It's going to, you know, it's a very scientific approach. It's a very interesting approach, and I think, you know, he has to be given time to look at his squad, consider what he needs, and try to bring in players. You know, I would think they will at least try and add one more experienced Premier League player or international player before the season starts. And if they do, I would be reluctant to write them out of this completely.
And Tottenham, why haven't they done anything?
Again, Modric, this is an issue with trying to keep players rather than trying to bring in players. I'm not sure that the funding is necessarily there. And I think if they can hang on to Modric, I think they'll probably... leave it at that. I mean, Ollie wrote a piece this morning, says they're trying to bring in Lassana Diarra, and they may try and add a couple more, but there's been a lot of inward looking stuff in London this season, and I think, you know, I think that's been difficult for them.
Tom?
Yeah, I think we're just waiting for kind of a domino effect, aren't we, in the last 3 weeks of the transfer window. There's still 3 weeks to go, and a lot of things will happen at the last minute, as they always do. As Ben says, Arsenal have been waiting to resolve Fabregas and Nasri before acting, but also Wenger just doesn't buy wildly in any transfer window, regardless of the circumstances. He looks like he's going to buy Oxlade-Chamberlain this week, which is, and Jovinho he's already bought, and Carl Jenkinson, which are his kind of signings, rather than the dramatic buys which people are calling for him to make. Wenger did say something interesting last week. He said that the market is fairly fairly static between 10 and 40 million. There's a lot of players going for under 10 million and a lot of players perhaps in the 30-odd plus bracket, whereas Arsenal are looking to shop in a 15, 20 million kind of bracket, and that market at the moment is relatively static.
Well, they haven't shopped very often in that particular market for a few years, and I think that has been part of their problem, hasn't it? And, an unwillingness to go over that sort of 10, 15 million pound mark has perhaps been one of their problems over the last few years. And if they're wanting Jagielka and seeing him as the guy that will hold together their entire defensive unit, and they've bid 10 million pound for him, and if Everton are saying, well, he's going to cost 16, 17, 18 million, I think they just have to bite the bullet for once and actually buy the player that they think will make the difference. But whether he does make the difference or not, I think if Wenger judges him to be the defender who can make the difference, then they have to buy him.
Isn't that a bit of a problem when you get fixated and say, like, ooh, yeah, we're getting into the merits of Jagielka. But I hear 16, 17, 18 million pounds for a guy that age, and a guy who's Phil Jagielka, and a guy who's a central defender. I don't know that there's any central defender in the world I would buy for 17, 18 million. I mean, if you look at the spending that takes place elsewhere, the non-Sheikh funded spending, because obviously Malaga and Paris Saint-Germain are a bit of an exception, but people just don't reach those levels for players of that profile. I mean, is there something wrong here, Ollie?
Well,
you're saying only Phil Jagielka can do a job for me, so I need to go and spend 18 million pounds. I mean, with all due respect to Jagielka,
I'm not saying he is.
Wenger is implicitly saying.
But the fact that they've made a bid for him and decided that, well, we rate him highly enough to think he can improve our defence, and we're going to make a bid for him. I think they must know they're not going to get him for 10 million. I mean, why on earth would Everton sell for 10 million?
Why would you keep a guy for 10 million when, you know, you're going to get X amount, you know, he's not going to have much resale value in a year's time. You don't have a lot of money. You've got some good kids coming through. You're a club that, you know, has a mess upstairs. Maybe 10 million isn't a bad piece of business for Jagielka if you're Everton, is it?
But isn't it about, I mean, what you can get in this market? I mean, this is a market where Andy Carroll costs 35 million pounds. I think, you know, there is this special case in this country, in this league, where prices and players go through the roof. It's a very different situation to Europe, and especially this premium on English players, which is why someone like Phil Jagielka is a 16, 17 million pound player.
People say that, but it's been effectively the same three clubs that have been sort of bankrolling this or have been driving this up. I mean, it's not like, you know, Roger Johnson, for example, right? Wolves, you know, he's an English player. You know, he went for what I think is a sane valuation, a very good valuation. You know, are we suggesting Jagielka is worth three times as much or Cahill with his expiring contract? Are we saying these guys are worth three times as much as Roger Johnson? Does that make sense?
Not at all, but I think if Wenger identifies a player and that's who he wants, then as Ollie says, he's got to pay the top dollar for him, which is perhaps as wrong. And Roger Johnson is an excellent player, and he's certainly not three times less a player than Phil Jagielka, but he wasn't the player that Wenger wants.
This is the whole problem. Arsenal put values on a player based on, you know, kind of theoretical values of what Wenger thinks they should be worth. But in reality, this is a market with fluctuating and prices, and this is capitalism, and he's worth whatever Bolton are prepared to let him go for.
That's fine, but the flip side of that is I actually think Wenger's right. I think you have to have some discipline and you have to have some logic and not fall in love with a player, especially a big burly defender, because the fact of the matter is it works both ways, right? If I'm Everton and Phil Jagielka's leg snaps in two, then I'm out 10 million. Same thing goes for Cahill. What if Cahill runs his contract down? You know, I mean, you know, it works both ways. I can tell you my house is worth 30 million. You don't got to buy it, right?
Yeah, if all clubs had the same transfer strategy as Arsenal, the world would be a better place and football would be a more sane place and a more responsible place. Unfortunately for Arsenal, because they haven't won anything in so long and because they have a large amount of money which they're sitting on in cash and not spending, and they're identifying players and they're not willing to go a couple more million, as was the case with Mark Schwarzer last season, which cost them disastrously in the end, they're just making themselves look bad. Wenger's saying, you know, we are behaving responsibly, but they can afford to be a little bit less responsible.
Ollie, I want to wrap this up with Liverpool. There's one thing that really strikes me. Should he maybe have bought a little more at the back and a little more up top and maybe ditched some of his many, many midfielders?
Well, I would probably agree with that. I mean, I think the midfield picture is clouded somewhat by the fact that people like Cole and Aquilani are still on the books, and I don't think they will be in a couple of weeks' time. I think they'll let go, and then the options in that area become a little bit less blurred. But I would say that Liverpool now have formidable midfield options and still have weaknesses elsewhere. So Liverpool have basically done the exact opposite of the Arsenal approach. They have gone for the players that they really want, like Carroll and Downing and Henderson. And okay, you can quibble with the choice of players, but they've gone for the players that they want, and they've paid whatever it would take to get them. It's the antithesis of the Arsenal approach, and I've got to say, a happy medium would probably be the ideal there, wouldn't it? I mean, you've got to be pragmatic in the transfer market, but I think they've overpaid in certain cases.
Just to conclude on this section, it's interesting what you said there. You know, they've said they've gone the opposite of the Arsenal approach and so on. I want to ask, what happened to Damian Kamali and Billy Bean and Moneyball and value signings? I mean, is Kamali still there? Has he changed his mind and his philosophy? Do they just keep him locked in a closet and not let him out, or what?
Well, the whole Moneyball thing would apply to Liverpool. It was a complete myth in the first place. I mean,
some people might say Moneyball period is a complete myth.
Well, there you go. But I mean, also, Kamali, when he was at Tottenham, I think his approach there was, I mean, yes, they would import some good young players from Europe, some of which worked out, some of which didn't. But the approach was generally buy good young British players. That's what the relative success of Spurs over the last couple of seasons has been based on, that period of buying young British players who have subsequently under Harry Redknapp's management come to show their worth. But I think the cost of buying uncapped young English players was then probably 5 to 10 million in the case of Michael Dawson, Gareth Bale, those Welsh, etc. And now it's and now we're talking 10, 15, 20 million. The market for that kind of player has just inflated beyond all sense, really. And I think an awful lot of clubs are looking at these things. I mean, Everton can look at Jack Rodwell and think, well, why should we sell him for 15 million when Jordan Henderson went for 16 million, rising to 20 million? And it's entirely right that there is a market for these players, and that market overestimates their true worth.
I still get the sense that the balance of power is shifting and that there's money in the Northwest, which just seems to be absent here in London. I don't know. Maybe it's the global banking crisis. Let's move on to something a little bit more cheerful that fills us with hope. I asked each of you to come up with your hope for the upcoming season, something you would like to see happen. And I'm going to start with you, Ben Smith, since you're always the best prepared guest we have on the show.
Thank you, Gab. Mine is a rather fanciful hope, but it's a hope nonetheless that we will see the growing return to the passing game, the ball, you know, staying on the floor, the you know, teams attempting to replicate the brilliance of Barcelona last season. I hope referees will allow teams to play and protect players in the way they perhaps haven't done in the past.
Protect players? Who are you, Paddy Barkley?
Getting that way.
You,
yeah.
you, you, You
do you
are.
Want me to do an accent?
No, but I notice you seem to be losing, you know, receding hairline. You're on your way.
Gav, you're a bit slow. That's been going on for a while, mate.
Tom, I know for a fact that you wouldn't be favoring this namby-pamby, soft passing approach, and you still enjoy the full-blooded, you know, hurly-burly of the Premier League, as they call it. So I know you're going to come up with something better than that.
Actually, I'm not related to on the pitch. I think it's time that we had managers on Twitter. I think we need all managers to tweet, specifically Ferguson and Warnock. I think this would enrich the game enormously.
Not Holloway?
Oh, Holloway can tweet as well. All of them. I think we've got players on Twitter. You know, so many players on Twitter now. We're getting used to that. I think managers on Twitter would be a good innovation for this season and would really enhance our lives.
I have to say, Mano Menezes, the Brazil managers on Twitter, and I actually am one of the sad people who follows him. It is amazing how completely anodyne his tweets are. It's, we are now at the airport. We will soon be boarding. We have landed in Curitiba. I am now at the hotel. It is the complete mind-numbing stuff. And I'm wondering, who would be the Premier League's worst tweeter, the dullest manager?
I'm going to say Paul Lambert.
Paul Lambert, there you go. How about that?
Just because he's very, not because he's inherently dull, but he's very careful with his utterances to the press. So I imagine he'd be also a careful tweeter.
Ollie!
Having been absolutely enthused and enthralled and captivated by Blackpool last season, I would like to see one or all of the newly promoted teams, QPR, Norwich, Swansea. I've got to get over the Blackpool thing. QPR, Norwich or Swansea doing the same, playing great football with a great mentality, winning games, going for it fearlessly. And I've actually got some decent hopes for Norwich and Swansea. And I know that it's very tempting to write them off as relegation fodder, but I spent a day down at Swansea a couple of weeks ago, and I just got the feeling, speaking to everybody there, that they are so positive in their outlook on everything that, well, either they're going to get the fright of their lives, or they're actually going to emulate what Blackpool did, and whether or not it is good enough to stay up, or they get enough points to stay up, I don't know. But I would like to see them giving it a real go, and I think they. I think having these smaller clubs, as I can call them patronisingly, in the Premier League and doing well and giving hope to others is extremely healthy. So that is what I would like to see.
That is a good point. Swansea and Norwich do play, from what I saw last season, do play good football. They do try to play. I just look at their squads and I think, my goodness. But then again, I thought the same thing about the Blackpool squad, and they nearly stayed up. So what do I know? My hope is much more practical. Having lost their funding last season because of a campaign by an evil man, I hope Supporters Direct regain their funding. They've regained some of it. I hope this insanity ends. It's completely absurd that supporters are getting the shaft because of the actions of one individual. This has nothing to do with the body, especially now that, you know, Swansea are a team that's I think the supporters trust their owns what, close to 20% of the club, and I think this is something that really ought to be encouraged and would help bring stability to football as a whole. So yeah, so Premier League, if you're listening, pick up the tab. You did it before. We were very kind. It was very nice of you to do that, to pay for everything. Please do it again.
And what's more, Premier League see sense over this dispute regarding newspaper and media coverage. I mean, that again is complete greed. And if they don't back down and see sense over the next couple of weeks, then they're not going to be having their product widely advertised in every newspaper and magazine over the next season. So,
but the product is their intellectual property. Aren't you stealing it by writing about it, Ollie?
Yeah, I don't quite see it that way.
Well, we can't really address this further because our producer Chris, his family members work for Football Data Co. when they're not busy working for Halliburton and other polluting companies. So we'll just move on, shall we?
I get enough abuse from listeners of other times podcasts to start getting these accusations. It's not true.
All right, time now for some quick hits. Okay. Tom, a lot of talk about the Premier League recently. Now, here's something interesting I thought was interesting. The Bud Selig, the commissioner of Major League Baseball, makes something like £12 million a year. His equivalent at the NBA, where most of the clubs lose money, David Stern, makes in excess of £20 million a year. Richard Scudamore, while I don't know exactly how much money he makes, I'm pretty sure I'd be shocked if he made more than $2 million a year. Now, does this mean the Premier League are getting a really, really good deal, or that Mr. Scudamore is woefully underpaid?
No, I think Scudamore's probably paid about right if he does, and roughly what you said. Premier League's a solid organisation, and he's running it pretty well. There's the odd big gaffe, like the 39th game, which happens now and again, but despite the massive amount of debt that most of his members are in, the Premier League is overall a very successful product. So
so it's the other guys who are overpaid, not Scudamore, who's underpaid.
Yeah, I think anyone who earns $18 million for being a commissioner of a sport, major league or whatever, is horrendously overpaid.
Ah, so speaketh Comrade Dart. England take on Holland this week in what we used to call a prestige friendly. Ben, are you a little bit excited? Or are you one of those nattering nabobs of negativism who has fallen out of love with the Three Lions and bemoans international dates at this stage of the season?
I am a little bit excited because it's England-Holland. You know, it's a big game of football. But at the same time, I think the international game doesn't help itself when it schedules friendlies 3 days before the start of a new season. It's hard to see sense in why they put it there. But it's an international game of football. It's England against Holland, so there is some excitement there.
Speaking of international football, Joey Barton has gone from troubled kid from the mean streets with a rap sheet to reformed tweeting savant. Ollie, you write about his not being called into the England team. Is this even a conversation worth having? And more importantly, if he's so good and you can get him for free, why has nobody snapped him up?
It's a conversation that journalists had with Fabio Capello over the weekend, and Capello was asked about Barton, and he said he's a good player, but he's dangerous. I think this perception of Barton as dangerous, I think, is rather outdated, whether it's with relation to his disciplinary record on the pitch, which is one red card in 4.5 years, or his reputation off it, which I think is basically grossly exaggerated in terms of what he's done since he's cleaned up his act 2.5 years ago. I don't think he's particularly a troublemaker. I think an awful lot of players are disenchanted at Newcastle, and I don't think his outbursts on Twitter, when you look at them carefully, I don't think he's really said an awful lot that would really create a lot of attention.
Gab, one for you. David De Gea and Manuel Neuer are the second and third most expensive goalkeepers in history. We know how De Gea got on at the weekend. Please tell me Neuer did better.
No, he actually did worse. Yes, that's right. It's kind of hilarious, actually. Bayern Munich were home to Borussia Mönchengladbach, and they lost an awful, awful mix-up with another new signing, Jerome Boateng. Neuer coming out late, nearly decapitating the striker who still got the shot off and scored. Bayern didn't play that badly, but this is really a nightmare start. And given how awesome Borussia Dortmund were on Friday, you kind of think it's going to be an interesting season in the Bundesliga. That's all we've got time for today, but thanks for joining us. And remember, you can go to www.thetimes.co.uk. You'll find your news, your gossip, your analysis. You can follow us on Twitter, huh? At Oliver K. Times, or what are you, Ben?
Ben Smith _ Times, obviously.
Ben Smith _ Times. And Tom?
At Tom Dart Times.
At Tom Dart Times. They're all different in their own way. Different, but all still special. You can also join up for our web chats. Mine is on Tuesdays. Ollie, when's yours?
It's Wednesday, 1 o'clock, Cap.
Wednesday at 1 o'clock. Mark it in your diaries. We'll be back next week and hopefully for the rest of the season. So please join us.
Listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot,
is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.